is equal to T chi of R minus R prime, where that's a susceptibility, which basically says that if you put a field here, how does it affect the spin here? Okay, we derived that. We also showed that chi of R minus R prime is the inverse of this matrix F some function of R minus R prime, where F, I guess, just write it down here, was T delta R R prime minus J. And J is the nearest neighbor coupling. So J, this matrix, if you like, in which is labeled by lattice sites, is this J has non-zero elements only for two lattice sites that are nearest neighbors. Okay. And the way you calculate this is by Fourier transform. The Fourier transform of F is sum over R e to the iq dot R F of R, say F of R and zero. Well, just I guess in this notation that would just be F of R. Put it that way. And that's T minus J sum over e to the I q dot delta. Fine. So now you see explicitly you only get contributions when the two sites are connected by the nearest neighbor vector delta. So now let's just, for simplicity, specialize to d-dimensional hypercubic so that delta, if you like, is a vector along x minus x, y minus y, z minus z. However many dimensions you have. Okay, so so delta then is equal to plus or minus 1, 0, 0. Or it's equal to 0 plus or minus 1, 0, 0, et cetera. And it has, as usual, z, the number of nearest neighbors, for this particular case of hypercubic, is 2d values. So this is a sum over two 2d nearest neighbor things. So basically, then, the result is that this is equal to T minus 2J times cos QX plus cos QY, however many directions you have. Now, we'll see in a minute or less that it's the values near q equals 0 that really matter. And so as a result, we're going to approximate the cosines by the value around q equals 0. And so then this is equal to t minus zj plus j times qx squared, qy squared, however many q components you have. And so f of q then is equal to, well, this is TC. And so you can factor out a TC. And then you've got what you've got here then is T minus TC over TC minus J over TC Q squared. And we're going to call this little t, and I don't know, we can call this j hat. Interestingly, it's just 1 over z. Okay, so now we have f of q. We can now calculate chi using the Fourier transform of the inverse. And so C of R is equal to T, which is T chi of R, is equal to T over N fine. And so that's equal to T over TC sum over Q E to the IQ dot R over T plus J hat Q squared. So, I mean, if you just want to this is pretty much all you need, although we can go on and on and just calculate it. But right away, you can see that close to TC, where this thing vanishes, you've got a 1 over Q squared. So it's pretty clear that Q around 0 is what's going to dominate this sum. Which we will now immediately turn into an integral. So that's just putting in all the dimensional factors, T over TC. The volume in D dimensions over the number of sites, that 1 over 2 pi to the D to go to an integral. This is actually an integral over the Brillouin zone. The d-dimensional Brillouin zone, e to the I so this factor here is just the lattice constant to the D. Actually, we're going to take the lattice constant equal to 1, so that, forget about that. Also, for a lattice Fourier transform, this is a sum over wave vectors in the Brillouin zone, but, yeah, Evelyn. Which one? This?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so we started out writing the Landau expansion for the free energy to quadratic order, just to quadratic order.
Right.
And that involves something that couples the, well, couples the spin at different sites. And that has a contribution from the entropy, which is just T, for each site separately. And then it also has the nearest neighbor coupling from the energy. Mm-hmm. So the free energy has an entropy and an energy contribution. Mm-hmm. And then there's a linear term coupling to the field. We worked with a local field so that we could differentiate to get local susceptibility. So we had a different H on every site so that we could pick out sites. And then the calculation only applies to T greater than TC, where there's no, where the average magnetization in the absence of fields is zero. That's what this calculation is for. And so you can ignore the fourth order and higher terms in the free energy. Okay? So then we have a quadratic form, which, if you like, describes the linear response of the, you know how, you know, your elastic constants, if you like, these are sort of like elastic constants for the spring system, for the spin system, these Fs. They tell you how it responds if you apply, in our case, it's a local field. Okay, so this is a linearized theory that we use to calculate the susceptibility in the disordered state. And because of the relationship of the susceptibility to the correlation function, we're actually using it to calculate the correlation function. Okay, so that's, yeah.
So why didn't we over the first gradient zone rather than the
this yeah. So I think Dennis did this at the beginning, but you may not, I could be wrong, or you may not recognize it. Okay? So basically if you want to represent a function which is just defined on a lattice of sites by a Fourier representation, the Q vectors that you use are not like all values of Q as you would for continuous functions in continuous space, but they're discrete. So they're vectors in a Brillouin zone, in the Brillouin zone. And basically if you were to add, so reciprocal space, you have Brillouin zones that you can repeat them by adding reciprocal lattice vectors. Okay, but adding a reciprocal lattice vector to this Q just gives you a reciprocal lattice vector times a lattice vector, which is some multiple of 2 pi. So it doesn't give you anything new. It's only the sum over the n values of wave vectors in the first Brillouin zone. There's n of them. Just like there's n sites, that you need to represent this function that's defined on sites. Now, what are the n values of Q in the Brillouin zone? Well, there's two questions. How big is the Brillouin zone? It's basically the size of the Brillouin zone is designed so that if you go from one edge to the other, it's a reciprocal lattice vector. So every point outside the first Brillouin zone could be mapped inside by translating by a number of reciprocal lattice vectors. So that tells you what the size of the Brillouin zone is. Then you also might ask, okay, but how are they spaced? How are the Q vectors spaced in the Brillouin zone, these n values of the Q vector. They're spaced by 2 pi over the size of the system. Okay, and that's what it is that gives you n of them, if you like, because if it's an L by L by L system, then your Brillouin zone has L by L points, each spaced by 2 pi over L. Okay, so I don't know if that's helping. Oh, I haven't gotten to the integral part. Yeah. So if L is large, then the points are close together, and you can replace the sum by an integral.
No, I mean just the sum or integral over all the Q.
Yeah.
Compared to the sum or integral over all only the first gradient zone Q. So is it only applicable for Fourier transform, or is that any other case which we can just sum or integral over the first gradient zone rather than all possible Q?
Okay, so first of all, if you do a Fourier integral over all possible Q from minus infinity to plus infinity, you can represent a function at every point in space. Space being continuous, infinitely divisible. Okay? If you simply want to represent points, a function defined only on a lattice of sites, you don't need all those Qs. You only need the ones in, say, for example, the first Brillouin zone. Okay, you need that many. In other words, to describe a function on big N sites, you need big N Qs. Okay, that's why you can. Now, but the other question is, that would apply to this sum. The next question you might ask is, but how do you turn the sum into an integral? Okay, you know that. Okay, fine. Yes.
Excuse me, in the second line, in the rightmost, T over T, is there n in the denominator?
Probably. Let me see. I think there probably is. I'm just trying to think of why did I write it without that. Yeah, there's an n.
And also, I think that should be a plus, not a minus.
Say this again?
F of Q.
At the very top of the board on the right-hand side.
But there's a minus there, and there should be a minus here.
No, it's a plus.
Oh, sorry. Let's see. Oh, yeah, it is a plus. Okay, yeah. Right. Yeah, that would be terrible for a minus, I guess. Because you get, that would be bad. Okay, so are we all on board now? Is there anything else conceptually worrisome about this? Okay, so I told you I'm just going to extend this integral to infinity. And so I'm just going to set t equal to tc, because the assumption is that we're above but near tc. So and so basically we have that the correlation function is 1 over 2 pi to the d, integral from 0 to infinity, q to the d minus 1, dq over t plus jq squared. Times, yes, some angular integral, e to the iq dot r. So now we're going to start, we're going to rescale the variables here to make the integral more manageable or to look nicer. So we're going to define by setting Q equal to the square root of T over J hat K. So everywhere there's a Q, we're going to substitute square root of T over J hat. And actually here we've got a Q squared, and so that makes this T plus TJ squared. TK squared. Anyway. So basically what happens here then, so we still got 1 over 2 pi to the d. And so we can pull out a 1 over t from the denominator now. And up in the numerator, we've got basically dimensions of q. Yeah?
For the upper bound of the integral, should it not be infinity because it just integral over the gradient?
Yeah, but you know, so the argument is that going from the edge of the Brillouin zone to infinity isn't going to change anything. Okay, so that's true for unless you get to too high dimension. I think it works for d less than 5 or something like that. But you'll have to check that for yourself. But yeah, this is an approximation. We're going to extend the point. I mean, but it does emphasize the point to this calculation that what really matters is coming from Q around 0. It's coming from the infrared, not the ultraviolet.
Would that be a singularity at the bottom line?
Only if you're in too high dimension. If you're like in 5 dimensions. If you're in 5, it won't work. You can't do that. You have to cut it off then. Okay, but for the dimensions that we're mainly interested in, it doesn't change the result in any significant way. But it makes it much easier to calculate. Okay, I mean, these are things you'd have to convince yourself of, but it's probably better to do that after you've got the result. When the size of the system gets larger.
Okay.
It scales, the spacing between Qs is basically 2 pi over the size of the system, linear dimension of the system, yeah.
Right, I see.
Yeah. That's how the Brillouin zone sums are defined, or the wave vectors in. Okay. So where are we? Okay, so I'm going to pull out a 1 over t here, and then we've got all these q's up here, and they're basically d powers if you put that together. And so we've got d over 2. We've got t over j hat to the d over 2 because of the fact that this is the square root there. Okay. And then... k to the d minus 1 dk over 1 plus k squared. So far, that's nice. And then this angular integral e to the ik dot root t over j hat. R. So basically, we've scaled the R, the every R, well, the only R, actually, carries with it a factor of square root T over J, which is the inverse correlation like this, you'll see when this whole thing comes out. Okay, so now we're going to put in some dimensional factors which make the result so I'm going to multiply and divide by j hat, and I'm going to multiply and divide by r to the d minus 2, and then when I do that yes then what I've got is I've got root t over j hat times r to the d minus 2, and then everything's divided by 2 pi to the d. And then everything else is the same. Okay, and now what I want to focus on is this, which we're going to call, if I can write this neatly, phi, which is a function of root t over j hat r. So basically what I'm going to tell you is that if you look at this integral, if you pull out a factor of 1 over r to the d minus 2, then this thing here is a function, is a function which we can analyze, calculate, and interpret. Okay, or in other words, we can do the integral. This thing, this factor, root t over j hat, plays the role of an inverse correlation. It has dimensions, if you like. It's always multiplying an r. It plays the role of an inverse correlation line. Now, this has already been sort of algebraically messy. And phi is some integral that you can do. I should switch notations here. Okay, but the details of this are worked out in that book by Harris, me and Harris. And even there, what you'll see is that when you get to a certain point where you have the integral in a certain form, then you have to go to Gradstein and Rizek and find the result. Now, does everyone know Gradstein and Rizek? No? Okay. How do you do integrals? Mathematica. Yeah, so that you can only do a really limited number of integrals. Okay, so Gradstein and Rizek, which in my day, I mean, I think we still have a couple of volumes on our shelf. So it's this book that's about that thick, and it's written by Russians, and it basically contains all of the integrals that were ever calculated in Russia, which is a lot. And I can tell you it's a lot more than Mathematica can calculate. It even has a few American integrals. As it went through volume, I don't know if it has any Canadian integrals, to be honest, but as it went through volume issue after issue, people would submit integrals to them, and they all get acknowledged in the introduction. Okay. Now, nowadays, it's available online, free, as far as I can tell. I mean, you can just go to there and look for your integral. The only thing is that you actually have to learn, instead of learning how to do an integral, with that book you have to learn how to find an integral, okay? Because the authors have organized it in a very clever way, where everything comes in a certain sequence. It starts out with a chapter or so on just basic algebra. A lot of mathematical identities, functions, properties of functions, and then it goes into indefinite integrals, and then after that it goes into definite integrals, and then after that it goes to indefinite and definite integrals of special functions. And then in the end, I forget what it does. It's got differential calculus and all kinds of things. Okay? So I don't know whether this is still relevant in the 21st century. I once spent several days just learning my way around that book. Okay? And I don't know. Zita, do you?
Actually, there's a web page, Digital Library for Mathematical Function, uh-huh. which contains that book and anything that came after that.
I see. Interesting.
And you can search through it. It's DLMF.
Okay. Neat. Okay, I didn't know about that. Yeah, actually, in my student days, there was Gretchen and Rizek, and then there was another National Bureau of Standards. This is before, almost before computers, not quite, where it actually was of some use to have a table of logarithms and signs and things like that, which you probably will never come across. But those were the two books. So Bromowitz and Stegen was the U.S. National Bureau of Standards book, and Gretchen and Rizek, which is a much fancier book, was the Russian one. Okay, so anyway, when we do this calculation, there's a certain amount of algebra that we do. We get it into a form which corresponds to an integral in Gretchen and Rizek, and then we write out the result. And the result is the following. It's 1 over 2 pi to the b over 2. Times this thing, root t over j hat r to the d over 2 minus 1, times the good old k Bessel function of d over 2 minus 1 of this argument. Okay? And this is, I mean, believe it or not, there's a lot of physics in here. I mean, this K Bessel function has certain properties. This particular combination of factors, the argument to the index times the K of the index for that argument, has the property that when the argument goes to 0, this goes to a constant. Okay? And it has the additional property that when the argument is large, it goes to an decaying exponential of this argument with a little power law correction out in front. Okay, so that's, and actually, you know, these K Bessel functions pop up all over the place. The one other place that I think of them is with the vortices in a superconductor, the super flow pattern, the speed at which the supercurrents going around falls off like a K Bessel function. That has an interesting property. It means that it comes down like 1 over R, close to the core, but eventually turns exponential. If it went like 1 over R all the way out, it would have infinite energy. But it's the fact that after a certain distance, which is in that case, it's the penetration depth, which provides the length scale in a superconductor. When you go out beyond the penetration depth, it decays to zero exponentially, which keeps everything finite. Okay. So that's the result. And now we can. If you note that this thing, that C, if you like, is the square root of j hat over t, this says, this goes like 1 over t minus tc to the 1 half. This tells you that nu is a half in mean field theory, which I think we already knew. Maybe we didn't. So this has the properties. Let me just pick this thing up a little bit. So this has the property that as C goes to infinity, and R is much less than C, well, then the property of the Bessel function is that it cancels out this it cancels out this prefactor here and goes to a constant. And so then I guess what I want to say is that C of R goes like 1 over R to the 2 minus D, or is D minus 2, sorry, D minus 2. Okay, so the important thing is because this phi goes to a constant for small r when r is much, or when the correlation length is much larger than r, or when r is much smaller than the correlation length, this thing goes to a constant. The only thing you have left is this power law out in front. So you get r to the d minus 2. And that says that in mean field theory, AD equals 0. In mean field theory. Okay, so maybe I can do this. For large distances, kn of x goes like root pi over 2x e to the minus x, regardless of n. So then C of r is then 1 over j hat r to the d minus 2 root pi over 2 from the k Bessel function 1 over 2 pi to the d r. It still has some power law, but it's not so important. In fact, it's another power, c over r to the 1 half. That comes from here, e to the minus r over c. Which, if you combine everything together, I should have just given you the result, not that it matters that much. Root pi over 2, 1 over 2 pi to the d, 1 over j hat. So what does it have? It has c to the 2 minus d. C over r to the d minus 1 over 2, and e to the minus r over c. Okay, that's just the result for large r. And this is approximately. So in general, this result corresponds to the form that we wrote down originally for the correlation function. So it's consistent with saying that C of R is A over R to the D minus 2 plus eta, some function of R over C. And then the statement is that in mean field theory, eta is 0 and G of R over C is equal to this phi. And A is 1 over J hat. Okay. So it's important that g of 0 is a constant, because that's what gives you the power law behavior when by constant I mean independent of its r of r. By constant I mean it's not 0 and it's not infinity. That's what I mean.
But it can
depend on that? No, because it's g of 0, I've said r equals 0. That's why that is a silly thing that I said. So the property of this g is that at r equals 0, or at argument equals 0, it goes to a constant, which is neither infinite nor 0. And that's what gives you this power law behavior, which is all that's left in that case. Okay, so now, I don't know how many times I've told you that it's observed that phase transitions that are called critical transitions exhibit power laws. I must have said that, I mean, maybe even 100 times in 4 days. Okay, so I thought maybe I should try to show you that that's the case. In what sense that's the case?
We always compute the critical exponent eta in that regime when r is less than the correlation length. I mean, why we compute eta in that regime?
Eta.
Yeah.
Okay, so eta is the exponent that determines the precise value of the power law exponent, right? Okay, so eta. Yeah. So when r is smaller, when the correlation length is very long, so that the argument of the correlation function in terms of r of the correlation length is small, then the exponential part isn't doing much. It's just 1. And the question is, what is left? And what is left is essentially, by definition, some power law that's characterized by eta. Okay? So in other words, the definition of eta is that the power law is 1 over r to the d minus 2 plus eta.
Yes.
So since eta can be anything, that exponent can be anything. And in mean field theory, it's 0. And in typically, it's small but not 0 in real systems. Does that answer your question?
I don't understand why we have to put the correlation length going to infinity to compute eta.
We don't. Well, yeah, we do, sort of, yeah. Because it's only when the correlation length is large. In other words, see that that combination effect, this phi? It has other power laws in front of I guess that's the point. They all cancel out for a small argument. And it's only this orphan factor of 1 over r to the d minus 2 that survives. Okay? So, I mean, so that's the point. There's the correlation function is a power law, some inverse power law, times a function which will be a constant for a small argument and exponential times some other power laws for large distance. That's the idea. Okay, so I just want to show you a few things. Let's look at some things here. Not so bad. I don't know if you can see. Yeah, this looks fine from here, anyway. Your eyes are better than mine, although mine are very special. Okay, so this graph on the top is the liquid vapor vapor liquid coexistence curve. So the vertical axis is temperature and the horizontal axis is density. And it's for several different compounds, which just happen to be all the rare gases. And they all, roughly speaking, fall on the same line. How did that happen? How that happened is that there is one point which was, so everything was normalized so that they all went through one point, which is the critical density at the critical temperature. So for each substance, there's a critical temperature and a critical density. So if you normalize the density on the vertical axis, sorry, on the horizontal axis with the critical density for that substance, and if you normalize the temperature on the vertical axis for the critical temperature of that substance, and then plot temperature versus density on the coexistence curve for all these different rare gas fluids, then you find that they pretty well all follow the same curve. Okay? So, I mean, it took work to get there because you had to make sure that they all shared that common point. But once they shared the common point, they shared the common lines. Okay? And so this is a very old result, although I think, so this is taken out of the book by Eugene Stanley, who wrote a nice little book on introduction to phase transitions, critical phenomena, which I'm almost certain we have in the library. And it has lots of good stuff if you ever want to read about these things. Also, interestingly enough, that curve that's going through the critical point is essentially is T minus T, TC minus T to the beta, where beta is very close to a third. Okay, although the quality of the data here, I don't think could be used to accurately determine beta, but that's what it does. Notice it's not a half, which is what it would be for the icing model or the lattice gas or things that are supposed to be, which is what it is for mean field theory, for systems that are supposed to be similar to this. So now down here, this is the sublattice magnetization of an antiferromagnet. I actually defined the sublattice magnetization in the last lecture. It's when you add up the magnetization of every site, but put in a minus sign for every other site because the antiferromagnet wants to be up, down, up, down, up, down. So you add it up with that phase factor, and then everything adds, and you get the so-called sublattice magnetization. And so this is the sublattice magnetization. It's a little hard to see the points. But this is the sublattice magnetization. And this is a log plot. So if you take a power law and put it on a log plot, it turns into a straight line. Okay? You know that. So this, again, follows this form. And again, as it turns out for this system, beta is about a third. Okay, so that's an example of how you would actually measure a critical exponent. You take a lot of data. I can't actually read the numbers here. But you want to have it over a wide range because you're doing a logarithmic plot. Then you just take the slope. Gives you the exponent. Actually, help. Anyway. So here's some nice stuff. Yeah, this one I really like. This is the superfluid density in superfluid helium-4 below the lambda transition. Okay? So in this case, the theory says that the superfluid density it's like the square of an order parameter or something like that. It goes like 2 beta, but beta is still about a third. And there, can you see the numbers? Because it's over quite a few. Let's see if I can. It's over several decades. I mean, superfluid helium is a really nice material because it has like its thermal. It equilibrates extremely well, efficiently. And so you can do measurements and you can stabilize its temperature just by controlling the pressure. And you can get, if you're really good, you can get great data. Gunter Ahlers, I guess, has done a lot of work on this. Yes?
Did you say below the lens transition?
Yeah. Is that right?
What is the lens transition?
Oh, actually, that it's a transition where the heat capacity looks like that. Okay? So that's why they call it the lambda transition. Yes, if you think that looks like a lambda in some. Okay. So the prediction for the heat capacity at the superfluid transition is you know, that's supposed to be an exponent, T minus TC to the minus alpha. But alpha turns out to be incredibly small. So it's almost exactly a logarithm. And what someone has done here is very nicely plotted three pictures of the same thing. Okay? The only thing that's different is the temperature scale. This temperature scale is in degrees. This temperature scale is in millidegrees. And this temperature scale is in microdegrees. Okay? And that's this property of the logarithm, that it just looks the same as you home in on it. The only thing that happens, if you like, is the baseline goes up. Okay. So then that, again, illustrates that people worked hard on these things and did beautiful work. So this is one more figure of data. This is Canadian data, Canadian xenon. David Balzerini, UBC, sort of devoted his career to doing exquisite measurements of the critical behavior of various phase transitions. And so I guess he was a real master of temperature control. So what have we got here? This is the temperature, fractional temperature, T minus TC, as a fraction of TC. And it's like, it's about, it's 1, 2, 3, and then if you put the ends on here, we'd say 4 orders of magnitude, getting very, very close to the phase transition. And it's a very accurate power law. And actually, this graph is in a paper, a very nice paper, with Ole Morrison, who's from Denmark. And basically, Ole came to UBC for a sabbatical because he knew Dave Balzerini had all of this data. And he wanted to use this extremely high-quality data to calculate what are called the corrections to scaling. In other words, that may look like a power law, but if you fit it to a power law and then subtract that off, you find the deviations. And there's theories for the deviations. We may even get to something like that in this course, the so-called corrections to scaling. And some of the factors that enter in there, ratios of amplitudes, are universal in the sense that they just like the exponents are universal. So that's really, I'd say, this is intended to convince you that when I say, oh, we have these power laws, that it's really true. Okay. So now I think we need to put up the screen. And now we're going to go talk about scaling. Okay. So what does it mean when you see all of these power laws? Right. What it means is that the thermodynamic functions have a certain property, which is then reflected in this power law of behavior. And the property is called scaling. And what I would say is that power laws go hand in hand with scaling. Okay. So what does that mean? So imagine you have a function which has this property. When you change its argument by a factor, lambda, the value of the function changes by a factor, k. Okay, that's an example. That function exhibits scaling, and this is what that means. Okay, it's just reflected in this identity. Now the question is, what does this say about that function? What it says about the function for this simple case is that the function has this form. It's some constant, which doesn't matter, times its argument to some exponent. And now the question is, what's the exponent? So to see what the exponent is, you just have to substitute this in here. And what you get is a lambda to the alpha, tau to the alpha, is equal to k a tau to the alpha. And the alphas and the a's disappear. And so lambda to the alpha is k. But lambda to the alpha is e to the alpha log lambda. And if you take the logarithm of both sides of this equation, then you see that alpha is log k over log lambda. Did I get that right? Yeah. So this property of this function for specific lambda and k means that the function is of this form and that alpha is the ratio of the logarithm of these two constants. And this is called one parameter scaling. Okay, now the Ising ferromagnet depends on two parameters. It depends on the temperature, if you like, T minus TC over TC. And it depends on H. Yes, Nicole.
This might sound very silly, but it looks to me like there are three parameters considered, lambda, k, and a, which?
Well, the a is just a multiplicative factor. It says that you can, you know, the function can have an arbitrary multiplicative factor out in front, but its dependence on its argument has to be of the form argument to an exponent. And then the k and lambda tell you what the exponent is. That's what this is supposed to say. It doesn't tell you anything about what a is.
Alpha is our one parameter?
No, by one parameter I meant that there's one argument. Oh, okay. That's really what I meant. I mean, in fact, it is, I guess. I mean, alpha is uniquely determined by k and lambda, but the fact that the reason why I call it one parameter scaling is because I could have said one argument scaling if you have a function of a single argument. Okay, So the icing ferromagnet. On two parameters. Which we call, what am I going to call it? Yeah, tau and h, where this thing is t minus tc over tc. And before we get into the scaling, I just want to say something about how we think of the free energy. Or another way of saying it is, how would you interpret the data? Okay. Because basically, this singular behavior associated with the critical point sort of turns on when you get close to the critical point. If you're away from the critical point, I haven't actually proven this in any way, but if you're away from the critical point, you don't need fancy theories. Things vary in some smooth way in temperature, which probably mean field theory does a reasonably good job of. So if you like, you don't really know about the singular behavior that accompanies diverging correlation length until you get close enough to the critical point that that is the dominant thing. But there's also this sort of what they call the regular part of the free energy, which, as I say, could come out of some relatively simple theories that only involve short-range physics. Okay, so what people do, and we'll do it over and over again, is write the free energy with two parts, which here I'll spell out. As a regular part and a singular part. And this is the part that you would think might behave analytically in its arguments around the transition. It might not, but you would expect this to be, well, you can say that this is sort of the analytic part of the free energy, if you want. You can imagine you have some thermodynamic function, and it's got some power law kink or peak or something, and you sort of draw a smooth background from which that arises. And that would come from this part. Yeah,
I'm sorry, but the thing on the left-hand side, so do we assume that K is a power of lambda?
I'm sorry, we assume what?
Do we assume that K is a power of lambda?
K is K. K is lambda to the alpha, yeah. I mean, the statement is that in order to have this type of behavior, F should have this form. So yeah, so it gives whatever result you see here, like K is lambda to the alpha.
Wait. But it just follow from what you wrote down.
Yeah, it follows from this. It basically follows from this.
So K is a function.
You didn't know. I didn't know what K. K obviously is a function of lambda, because basically you're going in there and you're multiplying tau by some number, and you're pulling a constant out in front. As you vary lambda, K is going to vary. In fact, it varies like lambda to the alpha.
But if K were, for example, lambda plus 1, then it would not.
No, but it won't. Yeah, it isn't. It's this.
Yeah, but then you
that's the point.
So
that's
you need
the
to
point.
Assume that K is not. So no. You need to assume that K is a power of lambda then.
No, no, it comes out. It comes out.
No,
in other words, for this relationship to be obeyed, okay, K is lambda to the alpha. That's what it is, where alpha is this. That's the only way that this can work.
I guess the question is, how does the second relation come out of the first?
This.
Yeah.
Oh, this is like your guess. You know, it's, you know, this is the answer. It's like writing down the answer that you know. It has to be of this form. Okay, and in addition, alpha has to be this.
Oh, so I thought we were deriving that from the first line, but that's
not no. We were saying that this satisfies that relation for this with this value of alpha. And this is what basically f has to be like this.
Okay, so we're not.
I mean, if you can find another f which has a totally different functional form, which satisfies this equation, then I'd be interested to see it. I'm not saying that you can't, but I mean, I don't think you, this is the solution. It's like solving a differential equation and guessing the solution and substituting it and seeing that it works. Okay, so this was just like a mathematical exercise here. This is like a mathematical exercise to show what this means about f, what kind of function it is that can have this behavior. Here we're doing a physics exercise, which is trying to interpret the free energy. Okay, and. And here, I guess, what I would say is that the thing that obeys power laws are the singular parts of the free energy. Okay, that's what has this funny. So where this thing here might be an analytic function of tau and h, this thing here clearly is not because it has all these fractional exponents. So really what we want to do is focus in on the singular part of the free energy. And then the conjecture is that Fs and I haven't shown, I'm not proving this, I'm saying this is the conjecture that obeys. And in particular, so that then we need three factors to describe that, which are something like this. F sub s and this particular form is chosen because, as you will see when we actually calculate the singular part of the free energy, expresses the underlying logic of what's happening at the critical point. Okay, but if you want to think of this as the abstract math thing, as the analog of this equation, we say, when we scale the parameters, we're going to get some constant. Instead of calling it k, we call it lambda to the d. Because lambda is arbitrary. We can pick that to be whatever we want. We call that lambda to the d, but we're thinking d is going to be the dimensionality of the system. But that has to come out of some physics. And then that is what you get when you scale by a factor here, which we'll call lambda to the y sub t. Now, y sub t we have at our disposal. So this can again be any number. And similarly, lambda to the y sub h, which is called the magnetic exponent, by the way, again, because we have y sub h at our disposal, this can be whatever number we want. So basically, there are three numbers here, lambda to the d, lambda to the y sub h, and lambda to the y sub t. And so the conjecture is that the free energy obeys this type of scaling. And so then, what does that say? So just like here, we say, so what does that say about the form of f? We ask here, what does this say about the functional form of the singular part of the free energy? And what it says, again, I'm not deriving this, I'm just writing down the answer. It says, that the singular part of the free energy has the following form. Tau to some exponent, which will be determined, times a function of h over tau to the yh over yt. So basically what it says is that if the singular part of the free energy obeys this type of scaling equation, then it has to have the form, well, actually, there are different ways of writing this, I should say, but this is one way of writing it, that it's some power of tau out in front times a single function of the scaled parameter h over tau to the yh over yt, h to this, the tau to this exponent. Okay? And again, we can check this by substitution and along the way find out the value of x. Okay, so if this is the form that fs has, then fs of lambda to the y sub t tau lambda to the y sub h, what's it going to equal? Well, it's going to have the tau argument raised to the x power, lambda to the x y sub t tau to the y sub t, to the x, sorry. Okay, so that's just substituting this into here. And then g of, so what have we got? In the numerator, we've got lambda to the y sub h, that's h. And in the denominator, we've got lambda to the y sub t tau raised to the y sub h over y sub t. Now, what happens in here is actually sort of neat, because when you take this lambda to the y sub t and raise it to this power, the y sub t's cancel out, and you just get lambda to the y sub h, which cancels the thing in the numerator. So this is equal to, actually, g of h over tau to the y sub h over y sub t. And here, this is equal to tau to the x if, and only if, I guess, x y sub t equals 1. So that then tells you what x has to be, 1 over y sub t. Now, did I make some big mistake here? Yeah, I did. So, yeah, okay, so we don't want this to be 1, we want this to be d. And then we get, sorry, is that what someone was calling me? Yeah. That's right. So then x equals d over y sub t. Yeah. Okay, we still have a little bit of time here. So, so now the convention is to define x equals d over y sub t as 2 minus alpha. And y sub h over y sub t is equal to delta. Okay, and then if you do that, then the singular part of the free energy is equal to tau to the 2 minus alpha times g of h over tau to the delta. And this is defined this way because the specific heat exponent is the second derivative of the free energy in h when h equals 0. So for h equals 0, fs of tau 0 is equal to g of 0 tau to the 2 minus alpha, and then specific heat. Goes like tau to the minus alpha. So that's the conventional reason for writing x that way. Another few minutes, okay. So the point is that if you look at the singular part of the free energy, how it depends on t and h, we're conjecturing that it depends this way. We can now then calculate these exponents, alpha, which we put in by definition, beta, gamma, and delta, which are related to derivatives with respect to the field. And I wonder whether I think probably the best thing to do tomorrow is just to start from here and do that kind of analysis. Okay. So rather than try to rush it, I also wanted to show you some experimental data that demonstrates this scaling property. So I think we should probably end here. Good.